AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson with you here on a Tuesday afternoon. And as usual on Tuesdays, we are joined by the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer. That's Patrick Houlihan. And make sure you go to MinnesotaReformer.com for the latest in Minnesota news and politics. As today, we are going to be talking about some news from the state legislature and also taking a look at some candidates who are running for the legislature this fall. We are going to be talking about this broadband bill that's being debated in the Minnesota House because it would allow potentially cities to tax internet providers and do things like fund public access and the streaming of city council and school board meetings. Very progressive sounding bill, but unfortunately, looks like it might not become a reality. We're going to be chatting about why that's the case. Plus, we'll also be talking about some fringe candidates running for the state legislature throughout Minnesota. So, Patrick, thanks so much for coming back on the show today.
Always a pleasure.
All right, let's start off talking about what's going on in the state legislature, because you might be familiar with how oftentimes cable companies have to pay a franchise fee to local cities in order to operate. And the money that are used from these franchise fees is used to fund things like public access or broadcasting of city council and school board meetings. Very common for many cities to do this, to tax cable providers to then go back and invest that money into the city. But as people continue to cut cable, cities are struggling to pay for their public programming. So the Minnesota House had an idea of trying to fix this, which would allow cities to charge broadband service providers a fee to place internet lines in their jurisdictions, which would be up to 8% of the provider's gross revenue. Now, from that money that cities could potentially collect, about two-thirds of it they'd be free to spend pretty much however they want, while the other one-third would be used for government media programming and broadcasting things like city council and school board meetings. It also would have allowed cities to negotiate with broadband companies to ensure equal broadband access within their communities. So overall, sounded like originally a pretty progressive bill, but it's hit some roadblocks in the state legislature. So, Patrick, can you fill us in on what happened with this bill on the possibly allowing local cities to tax broadband providers? Because looks like there was a lot of good things in the bill, but now it looks like, at least for this session, it's not going to be a reality.
Yeah, it hit some blowback. It was going to hit the House. It was part of a larger omnibus bill, and then they stripped it out, I think, yesterday. And I think the obvious reason is that the DFL did not want to be taxing people's internet service in an election year. That's my own interpretation. I'm sure they would tell you something different. In fact, the Commerce Chairman, Zach Stevenson, said, well, it's a decent idea, but we got to work out some of the kinks and we'll come back in future years. It seemed like a good way to raise revenue, for give local cities a chance to raise revenue, and which would compensate them for some of the right-of-way management when they lay this cable down that can create a mess. And there's just some concern that the cities don't have enough money to fix their right-of-ways after the cable goes down. But mostly it was a chance for local governments to raise revenue and maybe rely less on property taxes. And then, as you said, a chance to negotiate with the broadband companies to try to make sure that everybody has access. But this is interesting to me, mostly because it's just kind of another example of how this session is so much different than last year. And last year, I think most people would agree, was one of the most monumental sessions in decades. And it seemed like every time you turned around, they were enacting a huge change in law or program, from legalizing cannabis to a paid leave program. Obviously, the budget was filled with all kinds of important policy and progressive policy in particular. I mean, there was gun control. There was the PRO Act, which codified abortion rights, on and on and on. This year, we're just not seeing that. I think there is a recognition, even by some of the most progressive members, that this House majority, it's the House that's on the ballot this fall, not the Senate, But this House majority, 70-64, depending on how the national election goes, they're pretty nervous, I think, about some of these edge seats in the suburbs and in greater Minnesota. And I think they're trying to make sure they insulate themselves from issues that could be used against them. And I think, the DFL wants to tax your internet is a pretty easy one. It sits on a postcard or a piece of mail. Digital ads would be easy. You know, they could do it easily with digital ads as well. So it fits a pattern that we've seen this session where even when they've proposed some ambitious programs or policies, they've stepped back. They're just going to, I think, try to maintain their majority, maybe expand it, and then come back next year.
And going back to the idea of the using this broadband issue for Republicans as a potential wedge issue, yeah, that very much does fit in a broadband or fit on a bumper sticker that the DFL wants to tax your internet, because even though the tax is technically on the internet service providers, very likely that they would pass those costs along to consumers. In fact, reading through the article that Michelle wrote, this internet service provider has even pretty much admitted that that would be the case if this fee were to go through, even though, well, it's not, at least for this session. But going back to your point, talking about the idea that maybe this session hasn't been quite as productive as last year, is this pretty much just the idea that DFLers are nervous about this year's fall election? I know there was recently a KSTP poll which showed that the race between DFL and Republicans, at least on a generic ballot for the legislature, was pretty much neck and neck, although I don't know if I put a ton of stock into that this early, and the fact that the legislature is probably going to be tied more to the presidential election. But would many of these bills that they're proposing now, whether it's this taxing internet service providers or criminal justice reform, or even as we talked about last week, land use reform, which could have allowed more cities to build affordable housing, are these more likely to pass maybe in a future session? And is this entirely related to the fact that this is well an election year and also kind of a bonding year as well? I'm interested in your thoughts on this and whether these bills have hopes for the future, or are these pretty much just kind of dead the rest of the way as we go?
Yeah, I think it's important for people to realize who are not at the Capitol year after year or following it like I am, that it's often the case that major policy takes several years to pass. And it's actually, even if something dies, that doesn't mean in a legislative sense, that doesn't mean it's dead forever. Often it's a good exercise for the advocates to work with their allies, hone their media message, talk to lawmakers about the bill and why they think it's important. And so it's not uncommon for legislation to take several years to come to fruition. Certainly this was, even all the stuff last year, I think a lot of people were taken by surprise by some of the legislative victories. But the Minnesota House had passed a lot of it in previous years, or it was controlled by the Democrats. It just didn't go anywhere in the Senate because it had been controlled by Republicans. But that exercise, and sometimes it seemed like a futile exercise because they knew once it hit that Republican Senate, it wasn't going anywhere. But you do it anyway because, again, you hone that message. You hear the opposition arguments so you can prepare yourself either by making changes to the law, or to the bills, or making changes to your message. So all that is helpful. So even though I think when all is said and done, they're not going to have a long list of accomplishments this session. That doesn't mean that all of it was for naught. It is important to do the work, even if you don't get it across the finish line.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, especially considering all of the accomplishments that were put into stone last year, and the fact that this is an election year and typically a bonding year where we don't see the big policy changes that you see during a non-election year cycle. You can read more about what Michelle wrote on this broadband piece over at MinnesotaReformer.com, MinnesotaReformer.com. Sticking on the topic of the state legislature, got to talk about this because the DFL state party has disavowed a local party unit's endorsement of a guy named Judd Hoff, who is running to unseat longtime Representative Mary Franzen, who is a Republican from the Alexandria area in District 12B. Now, you might be asking, why would the DFL be endorsing a candidate who was, well, previously having the DFL endorsement? Well, there's a laundry list of reasons why this happened. Hoff was convicted of second-degree assault, a felony, back in 2021. Charges came after a confrontation with a man who angrily stole an American flag that Hoff displayed upside down in his car. Hoff sought to retrieve the flag with the help of a 23-inch blade. Then Republican Representative John Heintzman says that for years, this guy Hoff has stalked Representative Mary Franzen by digging through her trash, publishing her address and contact information, filming her at private residences, and relentlessly sending rude and threatening messages online. So as you can see, not too surprising that the DFL decided to disavow this guy and disavow their endorsement. But I think the bigger thing that comes out of this is that really, if you look at Mary Franzen's seat, it's heavily Republican, something like 70-30 or perhaps even more. So it's already very difficult to try to convince anyone who's a Democrat or even left-leaning to run in that district. And I think this kind of shows oftentimes that, well, if nobody's going to run, anybody who does decide to run has a good chance of getting that endorsement, kind of no matter their background. And that certainly is the case in this district. And we see this kind of all over the state and the country when you have some of these non-competitive races. You can get some, well, controversial people who are running on the opposition party when you don't have anyone else who's really interested in trying to win what's thought to be an unwinnable fight. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's a really frightening situation. He appears to have bought a house across the street from her for the sole purpose of harassing and stalking her. And, I mean, you mentioned the going through her trash and all that, and then he's got these, unrelated to Franzen, but he's got this second-degree assault. There was another case in which he wielded his machete, and he was ultimately not charged. To me, the problem is, I mean, you have the uncompetitive races, but, the situation where the party endorses someone, is a little unusual. I think it's, I've worked in other states. We didn't have this situation. And I think, I mean, I just don't know why we engage in this. I mean, I know there's some Minnesotans who will instruct me in why the endorsement process is so important, but I don't understand the value, especially in a case like this, because you wind up endorsing some pretty terrible people, as happened here. It also happened, by the way, on Saturday in a Republican district in Farmington, where they have an open seat there because the Republican Pat Garofalo is not running again. And they endorsed a guy there who is an election denier and kind of a 2020 election conspiracy theorist. He went to the house of he was trying to stop an election and was serving a city councilwoman with court papers and went to her home to do so. There was no reason to do that. He went to her home three times in one day. It led to an altercation. The endorsement process, because, I mean, I don't think that's what happened in the case of Hoff. I mean, I think I'm sure it's just like you said, it's a 70-30 district or whatever. It's like, hey, anybody want to run against friends, and okay, I will, okay, and then they all just endorse. But the other problem with the endorsement process is the people most engaged, as a lawmaker told me last week, the problem is that the people most engaged are the weirdest, because they're the only ones willing to go to some, you know, sit inside some gymnasium on a Saturday when it's 70 degrees out in April and sit there for 8 or 10 hours and, you know, grind out this endorsement. And I shouldn't castigate the people who are heroically, civically engaged. We appreciate that. We appreciate their efforts. But this is a downside of this process. You get these really hardened partisans slash people with nothing better to do. It could be either or both. And they're the ones who are picking who the party ultimately endorses. And then the endorsement, of course, but then it's confusing to the average person, because if you win the endorsement, that does not mean you're the party nominee. You have to actually win the primary. But the party will only help the endorsed candidate in the primary. Democratic voters have been smarter on this. Democrats have not nominated an endorsed candidate for governor since Wendell Anderson. It's back in the 70s, right? Yeah. 72, I think. Or 70, was it? I'm sorry.
A long time ago, essentially.
Yeah, right. Half a century. But Republicans continue to follow the endorsement. If you win the endorsement, you're very likely to win the primary. The endorsement still carries a lot of weight on the Republican side. And, the party leaders will tell you it encourages participation and grassroots activism, and that's something that we have a lot of in Minnesota compared to other states. And maybe the endorsement process is the cause of that. I'm not really so sure of that. But you do wind up with some real bad candidates getting endorsed, and that's certainly the case here with Hoff. It sounds like he's very unbalanced, and we certainly... as much as we often disagree with Mary Franson, nobody should be subjected to what she's had to endure from this guy. So hopefully that there's a local party unit, which is the one who can withdraw that endorsement, hopefully they will do so quickly and certainly move on from this.
Yeah, as you said, Mary Franson, certainly not my favorite legislature, but yeah, that's a little... weird to have someone moving across the street from you just to essentially harass you. Yeah, don't wish that on anyone. Do want to quickly just talk about this endorsement. This is unrelated, that endorsement contest you mentioned down in Farmington in what's now going to be Pat Garofalo's old seat, because unlike this Mary Franson seat, which we said is 70-30 or perhaps even more heavily Republican than that, Pat Garofalo's seat is much closer to being a 50-50 divide between DFLers and Republicans. So if this guy that they endorsed down in Farmington for the Republican Party ends up being the nominee for the fall election, that could cause some massive problems that potentially be a DFL flip.
I think this is suddenly becomes a much more competitive seat. I think this guy that they've endorsed, there's some red flags there. And you're going to see more research appearing, and as you say, generally a Republican area, but it's become more Democratic. That Senate district down there, the DFL did win the Senate district in 2016, and so before losing it in 20. But I think it's possible that it was with Lakeville's also had, or Lakeville Farmington, that area has had a lot of growth. And, you know, you could have, I'm speculating here, but you could have city people having moved down there. They may have, you know, more liberal values. And so, yeah, I think like a good candidate on the DFL side could potentially, at least for a term, turn that district blue. And that's a big headache for Republicans trying to win the majority.
Yeah, absolutely, since they're already behind the eight ball, trailing 70-64 in terms of the seat breakdown. Yeah, lose another one to the DFL? Well, that's another seat Republicans would have to flip in order to gain the majority. You can read more about what we were talking about on this guy Hoff, Judd Hoff, who is running in Mary Franzen's district, at least for now, over at MinnesotaReformer.com, along with Patrick's column on this. Again, MinnesotaReformer.com. We have been speaking with Patrick Houlihan, who is the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer. Again, a tremendous resource for finding the latest in Minnesota news and politics. Patrick, as always, thanks for coming on the show today.
Always a pleasure, Brett.
All right, let's take a break and send things back over to Matt McNeil on AM 950. See the world is in the grass. I don't know about you, Sack Noel. I don't know about you.